It's March 21st, 2017, Tuesday Night Live. All right, so we're continuing our discussion about the Egel, the golden calf. It's a very complicated story. At first glance, a person could make a mistake. You might think that, okay, the Jews sinned, and God threatened to destroy them, which we already discussed. But Moshe interceded with his prayer. As a result of which, it says that God, quote-unquote, repented. Which means that God decided not to carry out the punishment. So that would seem to mean that the Jewish people were saved as a result of the arguments of Moshe. Of course, God did not need Moshe to teach him that. It meant that the fact that Moshe rose to the level where he realized and expressed these concepts changed, elevated Moshe. And because that's a general question, we didn't really set it up as a question. Why should Moshe's arguments sway God? First of all, God knows all of this. So what's the point? The point is that it's a result of a change in Moshe. Only Moshe is changed as a result of these new realizations, and they transform him into a greater person, hence a greater leader. And thus, it's not stated outright, but that's the way we should understand it. That's a change in the people. Because, by and large, it's the leaders have the most significant effect on determining the level of the people. So a change in leadership is very, very significant. That's why elections are important. That's provided you get real change, and it's positive. I'm not going into politics, but that's the point over here. If Moshe Rabbeinu achieves a higher level, then this will be manifested in terms of his leadership of the people. And then they are deserving of being kept alive. Now, what happens subsequent to that, we know that Moshe comes down and he sees the reveling, which God didn't tell him about that. And then he smashes the tablets. Okay, that's the first thing that he does.
That was chutzpah.
No, it wasn't chutzpah. The question should be raised, well, who told him to do that? That's the holiest object imaginable. All right, so let's pause on that for a moment. Now, according to the rabbis state, I mean, they stated by way of making a point, not that they witnessed anything, but they said that when he did that, God gave him a yashkar, that means good work, well done. So God approved of the fact that he smashed the tablets. Why did he smash the tablets? To us it seems to be unimaginable, like a blasphemous thing. I always give the example of a rabbi on Simchas Torah, is when everybody dances with the Torah. It's supposed to be a day of rejoicing with the Torah, but a lot of times people get crazy and do all kinds of crazy stunts. So what if a rabbi would get frustrated and so angry that he would take a Torah and throw it on the floor? I think that he'd be in huge trouble. And nobody would say, well, nobody would defend him. What right did you have to do what you did just because the people were provoking you? Now, you might say that when Moshe saw the level of the people, he decided that they were not ready to receive the tablets. That would be a reasonable deduction. But if that was the case, that Moshe simply didn't want to give it to them, then he should have put it in safekeeping. That still in all does not justify the smashing of the tablets.
But he didn't lose his temper.
Well, I don't know. It doesn't say that. It doesn't say that he didn't lose his temper. It doesn't say that he did it in anger. So you're right. We could assume that he was calm. He just did it because he... Now, what we need to understand is why. What motivated him to do it, and what gave him the right to do it.
But this wasn't one of the reasons why he...
It's an immediate assumption that he did the wrong thing. Because it doesn't... That's not the approach.
Because God didn't tell him to do it.
That doesn't matter. That's not the approach. The approach is we don't understand why he did it, but we assume it's Moshe. It's not. We're not talking about an ordinary person that can't control his emotions. We're talking about the greatest prophet. Therefore, when we see him doing a certain thing that doesn't make sense to us, we need to ask the question and try to...
Give him the benefit of the doubt, for sure.
Well, we give him the benefit, true. Now, if it was a sin, it doesn't mean that he's beyond sin.
Right.
Because in the case where he sinned with the rock or hitting the water, that case, the Torah makes it clear that he sinned, even though it's difficult for us to see what he did wrong. Right. But the Torah, God condemns him. He's not going to enter the land. So when Moshe sins, God will call him to task, take him to task immediately. In this case, God doesn't take him to task at all. The rabbis interject that God actually congratulated him. Good work. So now it's a challenge to us. Whatever. First of all, we know that Moshe did it intentionally with clear thought. He had a reason for what he was doing. Okay, so what the answer that has been suggested is that when he, and you can't say it's because they worshipped idols and this was a punishment, because when he came down from the mountain, he knew that they worshipped idols. And he carried the tablets with him, so apparently God still gave him the tablets, which he was supposed to give to the people. But something changed. What changed was the reveling, which meant that it wasn't a high-level mistake. It wasn't no longer just an intellectual mistake on how to worship God, but it was a descent into a primitive form of paganism, which is a completely different phenomenon than what God had told him about. This he discovered on his own. When he saw that the Jews had now regressed to this primitive form of paganism, he realized that not only were they not on the level to receive the tablets, but if they received the tablets, it would be worse for them because they would worship the tablets. Their whole idea of the holy was distorted. They now see the mentality of a person that he thinks that there's something about the object. There's something real in the object. And this object has special powers. That's whenever people take an object and think it's holy, it's like the object is, you know, endowed. People, you go to the wall, the Kosel, and people touch the wall. And they, as though the wall is going to infuse them with a certain power. Truth of the matter is, there's absolutely no difference between that wall and any other wall. There's no difference between this tablet and any other tablet. Nothing. It's the same cement put together, and it's a wall. It's the
Kedusha.
The same thing with the synagogue. The same thing with the temple. The temple was only of significance if God dwelled there. If God doesn't dwell there, it's nothing. It was destroyed by the Romans. It doesn't matter. If it had special intrinsic powers, then how could the Romans have destroyed it?
But I thought we treat a synagogue like it's a holy place.
Because it's designated for an activity which is holy. The holiness is not in the place. The holiness is in the activity that's being performed there. And which is what you have to treat it with respect. Because it all signifies Hashem. It signifies Torah. But the same thing with the luchos. There's nothing about those luchos with the Ten Commandments that were, quote unquote, the handwriting of God. It's only an object which is intended to uplift the person. If the person sees that and he gets involved in the ideas and the concepts, then he will be uplifted. But if he doesn't, then he thinks that object is like a holy object. He wants to worship the object, then it's worse for him. So Moshe wanted to demonstrate this idea. There's nothing, I know it's very difficult to accept. He wanted to show them you can smash it. It's nothing. Nothing will happen. You are projecting qualities onto those stones that they don't have. They are just a means. The same thing is true with the holiness of a Torah. It's holy if you read it and you study it and you elevate yourself. If not, it's nothing. It's a means to reaching a higher level of your relationship with God. A certain power connected to a place. This is a place where so what? It's no different than any other place. It's only different if you use it to stimulate your thinking. The first thing that Moshe does is he has to deal with the ego. He has to deal with the calf. He has to break them from the notion that there's something special about this calf that they are worshiping. Because once you worship it, it takes on a new significance in your mind. So he takes it and he destroys it. He burns it, and he goes even further. He makes them drink the ashes. He mixes the ashes with water. He casts it onto the waters, and he makes them drink it.
Is that like a Sota kind of test?
That's what some say. I'm not going to go into all the intricacies of that, whether that was a test. In other words, then it would have an effect on those who actually worship. Okay? Could be.
Well, what was the purpose of it?
Well, the purpose was he wanted them to recognize. Some say that he wanted... The problem, again, with idolatry is that they elevate these things, gold and whatever it is, and they attribute a certain special character to it. You've got to take a person's idol and smash it, and then make it into dung, because they drank it and then it came out of their bodies when they would defecate. Or to show them that it's really an object of disgust.
Okay.
To make a comparison between things that we naturally are disgusted by, well, that same emotion should apply to things that, from a philosophical standpoint, should be disgusting to you. His first actions were to disabuse them, to destroy the ego, and to break them away from idolatry. Now, what comes next is his confrontation with his brother. We'll skip that for the time being. Because that's a very complicated subject that's worthy of a class in its own right. The role of Aaron. Okay.
To mention the fact that
I'm going to take up this very strange verse, because I'm not going to go through every aspect of Aaron's defense. As I said, that's worthy of a class in its own right, because it's not the kind of behavior we would expect of Aaron. We would have expected him to act in a different way. So we need to understand that.
Next week.
Hopefully that'll be next time. But then immediately after he makes them drink this mixture, so then it says, and this is on page 498 in the stone, chapter 32, verse 21. And Moshe said to Aaron, "What has this people done to you that you've brought upon them such a great sin?"
So he's blaming both Aaron and the people.
Of course. Well, he knows that this was a provocation. It would seem to me that the premise of Moshe knows that Aaron is a tzaddik. He knows his brother is righteous. He's a great, great tzaddik. That's why he's saying, well, what they must have done something unbelievable. He's not justifying them. He is saying, you brought upon them this sin. He knows what happened. So therefore, he knows that Aaron was crucial. And he can't understand. He's at least giving him a certain amount of leeway by saying, they must have really gotten to you. So what is it that they did that would... I think he's giving him an opportunity to defend himself.
Yeah, he is.
Because in spite of everything, he has tremendous respect for his brother, who was a great prophet. And then Aaron said to his brother, "Let not my master's anger flare up. You know that the people is disposed towards evil." That's a very interesting statement. What does that mean? You know that the people is disposed towards evil. Okay. They said to me, "Make us a god that will go before us. For this man Moses, who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what became of him." All right, so let's just try to analyze in general terms. In general terms, what's he saying? He's saying a few things over here. First of all, he's saying, you know the people, that they are disposed to evil. Well, what do you mean? That the people are disposed to evil. What does he mean by that?
Well, look how many times they went out to Derek ever since, you know...
I think that
Moses
was not exonerating Aaron. He was simply giving him an opening.
No, sure.
But that doesn't mean he's innocent.
He's not holding the people blameless, is what I'm saying. He's starting out...
Very interesting statement. But I think he starts off by saying that this whole situation was very, very precarious, given the nature of the people. Even though God had taken them out of Egypt, and even though they had stood at Mount Sinai, but you don't change your nature. You just don't change your nature overnight. Some people never can change their nature. That is, it was kind of ingrained in the people. And maybe it was just too much to expect that they would be subjected to this kind of a challenge. Because I think he's harkening back to this is something we can't overlook. And that is that, you know, we read about the enslavement of Egypt, and we focus a tremendous amount on the physical oppression and persecution and degradation. But we cannot forget that they underwent a terrible, terrible spiritual decline.
And this is the one that the Rambam, didn't die in the dark.
The Rambam writes that they practically lost the fundamental principle of the unity of God because they had been affected by the idolatry of Egypt. Moshe's mission was not just to go to Paro and negotiate. Moshe's mission was to the Jews as well. His mission was to bring them back. They were on the brink of extinction. So he had to bring them back to the fundamental, genuine Torah ideals, which is the complete renunciation of avodah zarah, of idolatry. And that was the whole idea behind the Korban Pesach, the Passover sacrifice. The Passover sacrifice was to pull away from the idolatry, take the sheep, specifically the sheep which was deified by the Egyptians, and slaughter it openly and show them that this action which you think will be a terrible thing because you're slaughtering the sheep is holy, the sheep is the idol. No, to the contrary, those who slaughter it will be saved, and those who don't will not be saved. The act of the Korban Pesach was the extrication from being under the sway of idolatry. So the point was that the Jews had to be extricated from idolatry. However, I believe that Aaron is making the point that that's when a person has been subjected to idolatry, even if now he's not doing it anymore, but it leaves its mark. It leaves its mark. It's there. It's a very, very powerful temptation, very hard to get rid of. And in moments when things are going well, and you're coping with life, and life is good, so you don't want to have you know, you're good. It's like I would say a very rough analogy I would use would be like an addict. And some people, I don't know if a person has become addicted. I don't know if he's. That's what they say. They're always an addict, even if they're not engaging. That's what they tell them. I think in Alcoholics Anonymous and all these groups is that you. It's how they introduce themselves. My name is Steve, and I'm an alcoholic. Even though he hasn't drunk in 10 years. That is, they want them to acknowledge that they have this flaw and they're always going to be an alcoholic. Hopefully they'll control it. Now, it means, so when is the danger point? The danger point for any addict is not necessarily when things are going well, although, I mean, you know, anything. But I would say under stress. When things are difficult and a person is under stress, then he tends to go back towards those activities.
You know, we don't really find too many examples of...
story in the Talmud about this great rabbi, and he was talking about the idolatrous kings. In this instance, I think it was Menashe, who was one of the worst idol worshippers, and sort of berating him. And then it says that this king came to him in a dream and said, had you lived in my time, you would have been running, hanging on to my garments to run with, to worship idols. Because you don't understand the nature of the power of the idolatrous emotions was so powerful, so you can't understand it. So therefore in your time, things have changed and that whole emotion is not the same. So you can be a big shot, so to speak. I'm just paraphrasing. And he changed the attitude of the rabbi. He realized that Menashe, he was a great person in many respects, but he couldn't overcome the allure of idolatry. So, therefore, we're not in any position to make judgments about the Jews at any point in time, because we are not... That's what they say in Pirkei Avos, the rabbis. Do not judge your friend until you have been in his place. Okay, that's one of the best lessons. Don't judge anyone, because you can't judge anyone. You have your own particular set of challenges. I have mine. I have my strengths and I have my weaknesses. And I'm very, very understanding about my weaknesses. But I can understand. I can make a good case. But the other guy's weaknesses are not justifiable at all.
But we get punished by the plague by not...
Important lessons to remember. Jeez. There's a very significant difference between...
Which one's your knife?
So-called rebuking and judging. Challenge on both sides. It's very difficult to accept rebuke.
But we have to do it.
And the rebuker should be sensitive, try as best as he can to understand the mindset of the one who he is rebuking in order that his words will be effective and not rejected. That requires a lot of patience, and that requires precisely not judging, because if you judge, you've already, it's a foregone conclusion that this person is a bad person, and therefore you're going to go about it in the wrong way. Now, what I believe Aaron is saying is that you must take into consideration, in other words, the reason I acted as I did is because I know the nature of this people. I know the nature of this people. They were subjected to this stress. And when a person is subjected to stress, he tends to regress, to go back to behaviors that are from an earlier period. Like he needs a fix. I can't get through this. He'll take a drink, or so on and so forth. Now, in this case, the stress was what? Was the absence of Moshe. They, the people, needed Moshe.
Did they deify him? Is that why it was so stressful?
The question being raised is, did they deify Moshe? That, you got to be very, very careful how you answer it. But to answer it, I would say that there are different types and degrees of so-called deification. They were dependent upon Moshe. For example, a perfect illustration would be what? When Amalek attacked, and Moshe commanded Yoshua to choose men who were capable of fighting, okay, and which he did. Then Moshe went up to the top of the hill, and his hands were stretched towards heaven. I wrote about this in not the past, the 2 weeks ago, Dvar Torah. And it says that when his hands were held up and they saw, so then the Jews were winning. But when Moshe got tired, and then his hands came down, and then the Amalek was winning. And so therefore they put a stone to sit down, and they held up his hands. They supported his hands. So you see that their emunah in Hashem was contingent upon the person Moshe. That means to say that the emunah, the belief, the conviction was not completely personalized, was not completely internalized. But very often people are like that. They are swept along by the belief of a very charismatic figure. If there's someone that's so charismatic to you and he believes so, you're caught up in that. But that's not a true belief, because once that person is gone, you don't have it. You never internalized it. If you internalize it and it's yours, it's part of your soul, so then even when he's gone, you're still going to have the belief. It's not content, but that's how we are. That's how kids are not on a level to believe in God, but their teacher, their rabbi, he believes, so it must be true because he believes. They're very much affected by that. That's why it's such a scandal when great rabbis or whatever great are found that they do not exactly live by the ideals they're preaching. Imagine the effect it has on their students. It can totally destroy
them.
What?
Devastating.
Devastating effect. So, I think that this is part of what Aaron is saying. That you know the nature of the people. And to a certain extent that is a defense of the people, but it's also a defense of my actions. I had to deal with the people. I couldn't reason with them. These people are people that not too long ago were worshiping idols in Egypt. True, they witnessed the miracles. True, they brought the Passover. True, they followed you into the wilderness. But they also needed to see your hands held up towards heaven in order to be able to have that confidence that Hashem would be with them. But now you're gone. We failed to anticipate the consequences of putting the people in a wilderness without Moshe. They're lost. Who is going to be the one that will connect them to Hashem? They didn't feel confident that they deserved it on their own. Great Aaron was. Which is, these things are not easy to understand. However, why it should be there, but why they couldn't transfer all of that emotion to Aaron, why he couldn't take the place of Moshe, is a question that we don't have the answer. We can speculate all we want. Apparently, it was Moshe. You can't get any greater than Moshe. He's the one who went up to the mountain. He's the one that they saw God speaking to, or heard God speaking to. So that's something that Aaron can't bring to the table. He can't duplicate that. He is the quintessential man of God. Now, if you put yourself in that position and try to go along with what I've evoked, now they're in the wilderness and they're all alone.
So they were trying to...
What Aaron is trying to explain is that the intentions were good. Well, the way he understood it, he was simply trying to keep them in line to prevent them actually from sliding into idolatry by giving them some type of a... This would serve as a means that they wouldn't worship the idol. They would worship Hashem. The idol would be, however they understood it, would be... So they needed some kind of a visible mechanism which would be the means by which God would continue his relationship with them. Now I can't explain why this calf would serve such a purpose, but whatever, that we don't need to know. What we do need to... Aaron determined that he could not stop them. Well, bear in mind also, he did not, this will come important point later on, there was no outpouring of support from the rest of the people behind Aaron to really get these people in check.
The others didn't help him.
Nobody came to his... We don't see that there should have been, and now you'll understand why the people...
The Levites did, right?
The Levites. That we'll get to probably next week. But it could have turned out differently. There was a punishment for the people at large, not only for the ones who worshipped the idol. Because when a thing like this takes place, it becomes a national sin. And there are certain situations where you can't sit on the side.
Well, it's what they're doing in Tel Aviv now.
What's happening in Tel Aviv?
The gay thing.
Oh, well, okay.
We can't sit by idly on the side.
You can't sit on the sidelines and say, look, I'm not doing it. I'm not involved in this. That's true. But there are situations where you must oppose it. And you must join with those who are... In other words, if you're there, you've got to get behind the Aaron. Just like the Levites. Well, the Levites too, until Moshe organized. See, Moshe, had Aaron behaved like Moshe, it might have been different. Apparently, he didn't think he would have that authority. Moshe summoned whoever is for God, come to me. And the Levites joined him. Because we're now going to embark on a punishment. Very, very, very difficult challenge to punish all of those who worship the idols. That was the next thing that he had to do. That was part of the atonement. Well, we find that in the book of Devarim when Moshe recounts the story.
But they had to deserve it.
Tangentially.
That.
Of course. God sometimes intervenes with open miracles.
So if the people were...
Sometimes he intervenes with open miracles. Like in the case of the splitting of the Red Sea. And sometimes he intervenes by helping in the background. Hidden miracles. But the Jews have to do the brunt of the fighting. But in all cases, with divine providence, generally speaking, the Jews have to be worthy of it.
If Moses
asked the question, can the hands of Moshe wage war? And they answered, but no, every time they looked up to Moshe, they thought of their Father in heaven, and this, they subordinated themselves to God in heaven, and this gave them the ability to fight.
Okay, all right, I get it.
Not everything, God created sense. The world, God created the natural order. Essentially, he wants us to operate within the natural order. If God has to come down every 5 seconds and do another miracle, then there's no point in giving and putting us into this world. Okay. The whole idea of putting us into this world is that we have to learn how to deal with it. God will help us.
You're looking at Aaron's punishment.
I found it. As far as the punishment of Aaron, in Deuteronomy, Devarim, chapter 9, Moshe recounts the story of the golden calf. And he tells them how he prayed in the 40 days and 40 nights because he was afraid that the anger of God shouldn't consume them and so forth. All right, I'm just going to quote this verse. Then after saying that, he says, and God listened to me also in this time. In other words, he concludes that part, that God listened to me and didn't destroy the people. Then he says, and with regard to Aaron, God became very angry to destroy him. Hashem became very angry with Aaron to destroy him. Okay? So I prayed also for Aaron at that time. In other words, Aaron was also marked for destruction because Aaron was responsible.
Did it say that Moses prayed for Aaron too?
No, this is communicated to us in the Bible. It doesn't say it over here.
That's interesting.
The thing is that the fact that Aaron acted with good intentions is not sufficient.
Yeah, but are we?
Now, so he's sort of explaining to Moshe what motivated him. And then he tells him what they did. They said, make a god that shall walk before. In other words, the concept was not that they should have a god to worship, but only a god which would serve as a medium between God and the people in the place of Moshe. Now, then he said in verse 24, and I said to them, who has gold? Remove it and give it to me. Okay, so that's also part of his explanation, that he made a mistake. He thought that they would hesitate to cast their gold. He thought they would hesitate. Now here's a very important verse. Verse 24 is extremely important, and I think it has led many people to misunderstand. Specifically, David, you made the point that it would appear, if you read the verse, that he just threw in the gold and automatically, by itself, the calf came out. Now, if you read this pasuk simplistically, it might convey that impression. Because it says, I said to them, who has gold? Remove it. Okay, please remove it. They removed it and gave it to me. And I cast it in the fire and this calf came out. I cast it in the fire and this calf came out. Now what is he saying? That it was a magical thing? How can anybody take that seriously? Nobody could do that. Nobody can just take a bunch of gold or any metal and throw it in the fire. No form will come out. It's not going to come out the form of a calf. In order to have that, you need design. The only thing you would say then, only God could do that, but why would God do that?
But the rod went into the Niobe.
Now, in actuality, in point of fact, it was Aaron that, I assume he chose the design. And you could ask, why did he choose the design of a calf? And you perhaps can come up with reasons. But what's the meaning of this verse? It's part of his explanation, and the words are not to be taken literally. That is, my intention was that this, I would give them something that would serve as a medium, not as an idol. But it didn't work out right. He has to explain, so what happened? How come they're worshiping it? Well, what came out was this egel. In other words, the egel that they worshiped came out. In other words, this mess came out of it. And what came out of this was this mess of the egel, the sin of the egel. That's what he's referring to. Paraphrase, I just threw it in there with the intention that I just mentioned to you. Okay, how it got the form of the calf as opposed to the form of something else is not really important. We don't really care. But that was a design. But he's not explaining that because that's not the issue. He's explaining that my intention was A, that it should serve. But what came out, not by my intention, but what came out by unanticipated consequences was this egel, meaning this sin of the egel came out.
Well, that's a nice drush.
He's explaining, no, that's not the drush, that's the meaning of the verse. Because you can't interpret it. No one's going to say that the plain meaning of the verse is that he just threw some gold into a fire and out came a beautifully shaped egel. No, that's not possible. Unless God did it, because God's the only one that can do it, but then why would God do it? God doesn't do things like that. Okay. And then why would you have a complaint?
Right.
If that's the truth, if Aaron just threw it in, first of all, that people think he's crazy. Because what's the result going to be? Just a heap of gold, which is melted. A heap of melted gold. That's all you're going to have. Unless you say, well, no, God caused it. So then you're going to have to say that God misled them by God. God provided them with the golden calf.
Yeah.
Then he would have said that. Then he would have said, I had nothing to do with it. I never made. Then Aaron would have said, I never made the golden calf. I never made it. I just took gold and I threw it in the fire. And that's not true. So you have to make certain inferences. You have to infer that he did. But he's not talking about that. He's talking about this Egel, meaning this sinful Egel, which became an object of worship, that came about with no intention of mine, because I didn't understand the whole nature of the situation. Because the people have this deeply buried but very, very powerful need for idolatry under the stress of the situation. He's basically saying, I misread the situation. This was unintended consequences. That's my defense.
Okay, all right, that makes sense.
The question that's being raised is, why the plague? Okay, the punishment manifested itself in two ways. First, the actual sinners, those who worshipped the golden calf. So for that, there's different opinions, but for that, he gathered the people of the Levites. They were loyal to Hashem, and they executed the people that did the overt worship, and that they knew. They were witnesses, and so on and so forth. Of that, you had 3,000. But there were many, many more who had sinned. Not just those 3,000. There are many, many more who maybe worshipped it, but no one saw. Or maybe worshipped it in their mind. Or maybe were agreed with it and supported it. That is, you'll always have that in a certain movement. For example, there's different levels. Like, let's say there's a demonstration, and you have rioters, and they smash a property and so on and so forth. But behind them, you have many others who egged them on, who joined it, who supported it. So when it came to the sin of idolatry, the nation was not off the hook. That's what Moshe went to pray. The nation was not off the hook. Just because you did not worship it in a clear, visible manner, which would make you eligible for the death penalty, because the tribe of Levi, they can't just go around killing people. They can only do it for a crime. So they needed evidence that there was a crime. But that would be limited. There were many other people who were guilty of idolatry, but they didn't commit it in a manner which would allow the...
Okay, so there's no evidence here then that says that one of the reasons why Hashem...
The ones that didn't worship it, but who were punished by the plague, it's feasible to say that that would include people who supported it, or people who worshipped it, but not in a visible way. That, you know, or people who didn't even worship it, but supported it,
okay,
or believed in it.
Okay.
I think you might even include some people that could have rebuked and didn't rebuke.
No. We don't know that.
These are various opinions.
Is that one of the opinions that we didn't rebuke?
It makes sense because there is a collective guilt over here. There's a national guilt for those who... This is an important teaching. Of course, the Rambam says that someone who's in a position to rebuke, that is, he might listen to you. He might listen to you. And the person doesn't rebuke is guilty. He becomes... Part of that sin becomes connected to him as well. So if you have a friend or an acquaintance or a relative or a child, anyone that's going in a bad way, and you retain a certain influence, and he might listen to you, but you fail to rebuke him for whatever reason, indifference and so on and so forth, then you're guilty. You're guilty. And you can be punished for that. That's very serious. Because we believe that each person has a responsibility to others, especially in the area of sins. And here too, if there were people that could have stopped it and didn't, then they definitely could have been part of the plague.